Joshua chapter 8. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid, do not be discouraged. Take the whole army with you and go up and attack Ai. For I have delivered into your hands the king of Ai, his people, his city, and his land. You shall do to Ai and its king as you did to Jericho and its king, except that you may carry off their plunder and livestock for yourselves. Set an ambush around the city." So Joshua and the whole army moved out to attack Ai. He chose 30,000 of his best fighting men and sent them out at night with these orders. "Listen carefully. You are to set an ambush around the city. Don't go very far from it. All of you be on alert, and I and all with me will advance on the city. When the men come out against us, as they did before, we will flee from them. They will pursue us until we have lured them away from the city, for they will say, 'They are running away from us as they did before.' So when we flee from them, you are to rise up from ambush and take the city. The Lord said, the Lord your God will give it to into your hand. When you have taken the city, set it on fire. Do what the Lord has commanded. See to it. You have my orders." Then Joshua sent them off, and they went to the place of ambush and lay in wait between Bethel and Ai, to the west of Ai, but Joshua spent that night with the people. Early the next morning, Joshua mustered his men, and he and the leaders of Israel marched before them to Ai. The entire force was with him, and the entire force that was with him marched up and approached the city and arrived in front of it. They set up camp north of Ai with the valley between them and the city. Joshua had taken about 5,000 men and set them in ambush between Bethel and Ai to the west of the city. They had the soldiers take up their positions, all those in the camp to the north and north of the city, and ambush to the west of it. That night, Joshua went into the valley. When the king of Ai saw this, he and all the men of the city hurried out early in the morning to meet Israel in battle at a certain place overlooking the Arabah. But he did not know that an ambush had been set against him behind the city. Joshua and all Israel let themselves be driven back before them, and they fled toward the desert. All the men of Ai were called to pursue them, and they pursued Joshua and were lured away from the city. Not a man remained in Ai or Bethel who did not go after Israel. They left the city open and went in pursuit of Israel. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Hold out toward Ai the javelin that is in your hand, for into your hand I will deliver the city." So Joshua held out his javelin toward Ai. As soon as he did this, the men in the ambush rose quickly from their position and rushed forward. They entered the city and captured it and quickly set it on fire. The men of Ai looked back and saw the smoke of the city rising against the sky, but they had no chance to escape in any direction, for the Israelites, who had been fleeing toward the desert, had turned back against their pursuers. Mm-hmm. For when Joshua and all Israel saw that the ambush had taken the city and that smoke was going up from the city, they turned around and attacked the men of Ai. The men of the ambush also came out of the city against them, so that they were caught in the middle, and the Israelites on both sides. Israel cut them down, leaving them neither survivors nor fugitives. But they took the king of Ai alive and brought him to Joshua. When Israel had finished killing all the men of Ai in the fields and in the desert where they had chased them, and when every one of them had been put to the sword, all the Israelites returned to Ai and killed those who were in it. 12,000 men and women fell that day, all the people of Ai. For Joshua did not draw back the hand that held out his javelin until he had destroyed all that lived in Ai. But Israel did carry off for themselves the livestock and plunder of that city, as the Lord had instructed Joshua. So Joshua burned Ai and made it a permanent heap of ruins, a desolate place to this day. He hung the king of Ai on a tree and left him there until evening. At sunset, Joshua ordered them to take his body from the tree and throw it down at the entrance of the city gate. And they raised a large pile of rocks over it, which remains to this day. Then Joshua built on Mount Ebal an altar to the Lord, the God of Israel, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the Israelites. He built it according to what is written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of uncut stones on which no iron tool had been used. On it, they offered to the Lord burnt offerings and sacrificed fellowship offerings. There, in the presence of the Israelites, Joshua copied on stones the law of Moses, which he had written. All Israel, aliens and citizens alike, with their elders, officials, and judges, were standing on both sides of the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, facing those who carried it. The priests, who were Levites, half the people stood in front of Mount Gerizim, and half of them in front of Mount Ebal, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had formally commanded when he gave instructions to bless the people of Israel. Afterward, Joshua read all the words of the law, the blessings and the curses, just as it is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses had commanded that Joshua did not read to the whole assembly of Israel, including the women and children, and the aliens who lived among them.
Thank you, Jeff, for reading that for us. Appreciate that. Before I begin, as I should always do, are there any questions, first of all? Anything caught your attention? Chapter 8 that says, what's that mean? Yes.
They got to take the plunder this time.
They got to take the plunder this time? That's true. That's, as I mentioned before last week, they were unable to do so for anything else except now. Yes, Tammy.
Yeah, I also noticed that last time Joshua said, oh, y'all just send a few men over there and, you know, do what you need to do. This time, not only does he lead the army himself, like you had said earlier, he should have been doing, but he sent everyone.
Everybody. Everybody was there.
No more conceit of, oh, they're just an itty-bitty little town.
Right. Everything needed your full ability to take, which is an important lesson that I wish they had taken with them after Joshua's death, but they chose not to. Any other questions or comments regarding that? Or any issue?
Quite the overtaking.
Oh, you mean as far as how they took them out? It was a very elaborate plan this time around. Mm-hmm. And this note, this is, I believe, the most, in my opinion, elaborate plan Joshua had to do with regarding any town or city. Everything else was pretty straightforward, except I, or AI, however you pronounce it. Okay. Well, I have a few issues to talk about. Most of my comments are in the last part of the chapter regarding the blessings and the cursing section, but we'll do a few comments earlier on regarding the actual battle itself. As it was pointed out, it was the plunder was taken, which was unlike any other before, as well as every other battle they do now. The Israelites are allowed to take what plunder is involved with it. As we mentioned previously, God did all the work on Jericho. And Israelites didn't lose any people. No one died. They just couldn't take it. And, of course, we have the scenario with Achan, who then took it, or took of the plunder. AI does not have the same restrictions. And thus, plunder can be taken. Now, of course, women and children and everything else are still killed, which is typical. Women and children are killed. Why would they kill women and children? Comments. What do you think the reasons are?
Bad stock.
Bad stock?
So the women would still have their gods. If they were to bring them in, they would be a pollution to the Israelites.
Exactly.
To protect the people.
Because that's what happens, is that if your sons marry into those women who are now available, though they may not want you, it will pollute you and your children. And that's what happens. It happens to Solomon, as we all know, various women he had. It corrupted him quite thoroughly, as far as even to the point of doing various things, worshiping other gods while he was king, which was obviously frowned upon for plain reasons. How were the women able to do that? Well, in Jewish tradition, males really don't have much influence on your children until they come a certain age. Then the father says, all right, son or daughter, this is what my tidbit of information is about you, and takes as far as the rearing up to the point when the child is then no longer in the parents' household anymore. Women usually had that role, obviously until two, until a child was weaned, very typical, 2 years old, biblically child to wean about two. Then the male, as far as sons are concerned, are then to take the child and then rear them up as a male into their household. Well, it was common through shepherd lifestyle as well, these are all dairymen pretty much and shepherds, that's how life was. So it's quite easy for a woman to influence her child early on. We have the kings that had the same exact problem, that the king was good, but his son was the exact opposite. Well, how is that possible? He was raised with the same guy, wasn't he? No, he wasn't. The son was raised by his mom, who could be the queen of whoever or wherever, with her own belief system, a belief structure. So it corrupted Israel quite frequently, and we'll read across that as we go through the kings and the chronicles of every king and screw up that ever was in the whole time. So they had to kill the women and children. Of course, the plunder was theirs. So this was a great woohoo for the people of Israel who got to take the material. And also a slight revenge for the 36 men who died previously. This is a side note, but it's actually important to me because it's quite fascinating. And we're going to get into that toward the latter half of the same chapter. Where was Joshua and all of his men as far as drawing the city out? What side of the city were they on?
West.
No, Joshua's men, no, that was the ambush was on the west. Which he just destroyed that for me. But anyway, Joshua was all, they said that they approached the city. You would think they were on the east side, right? If his ambush was on the back behind the city. So the ambush behind the city. He wasn't. Joshua and all of his men were on the north side. But behind the city is the west. And these men that were in the city somehow got trapped between the west and the north. Well, why didn't they run southeast and escape?
Mountains.
No, they had no mountains in this particular case. Fortunately, they were not confined by the mountains. Why didn't they run away? What's the deal? Isn't that difficult to run? No comments? No questions? Bethel was further west.
West.
Bethel was was further west than Ai. And they're actually a short distance away from each other, about a mile or so, 2 miles max. The short travel.
Some other power that was blocking their movement elsewhere?
There's a valley between them.
Yeah, there's a valley between them. There, this power, they were prevented from going southeast, even though they were prevented from the rear of the city, which is the west side, and the north of the city, which Joshua was on in location territory. Why did they fear heading southeast? What's southeast?
Dead Sea.
Edom.
Well, southeast, actually, look a little bit map. It's kind of hard in this particular map to see. It's actually hard to locate Ai because Ai no longer exists, but it's approximately in this area. Southeast of Ai is heading straight to Jericho. Well, they're petrified of Jericho because of what happened. They're scared of Jericho. If I have a huge army on my, in this case, my backside, which is the west, I have a huge army on my left side, which is the north, and I've got God, the God of Israel's, on my southeast side, I'm trapped. I can't go anywhere. Hence, the men were afraid. They're easier to kill. It wasn't that hard to take over the area because they're petrified of Jericho. I would be too if I was in their shoes. Jericho's not a short distance, I mean, it's not a long distance away. It's actually quite short. They could make it there in a matter of a few hours if they were running. Obviously not full sprint, they get exhausted. But if they were trying to travel there, get there rather quickly. But they're afraid of Jericho. Everybody fled from that area. And this is not the only part that they flee from. Because Ai is afraid to run there. Bethel does not come to Ai's rescue, even though they could have. And the latter half of the chapter, Jericho and all his people head up to Shechem. Well, where's Shechem? Shechem's farther north. And guess what they found? Absolutely nothing. Where are all the people of Shechem? they ran to? Didn't God say, oh, make the people of Canaanite flee from wasps and bees? They didn't have to fight anybody in Shechem, even though Shechem was a major metropolis area at this time, and not obviously not to Jericho's scale, but it was still a fairly good-sized city. And they fought, go up there, and there's no one to fight. They didn't have to fight them. They all ran away. I would, too. So that was interesting. I just found it interesting as far as how the people and the interaction of the natives start worrying and their reactions to this oncoming Israel, which comes and attacks them. And Joshua does not go up to Shechem to go to battle. He goes there to bless the children of Israel, and then comes right back south again. Then continues on the rampage of the southern half of the country. He doesn't keep traveling north till much, much later. So it's just a quick excursion up and coming back and happened to run into nobody. These are all side minor points, but they're kind of interesting to me. Joshua's spear. But it says quite plainly that, as we all know, commanders in military battle, they don't actually go into battle. Today they don't do that. They're in our case, somewhere in Nevada, for example, or some other country much further away, and communicate via computers and say, all right, you do this, you do that, and they manage it much further distance. Joshua went into battle. Not only did he go into battle, he went into the very worst place to be, which is the bait. He was amongst the people who said, all right, if anyone's going to have casualties, it's going to be his little group, which isn't that little, but that group's going to have casualties because that's where they're going to be running away. And if someone's going to be behind you, you're running that way, it's easy to kill you. So he was in the worst place to be, held up a spear, and he raised his spear up and held it the whole time. Why would he do that? Why do you think he would raise his spear up, think back to Moses, and hold it the whole time, through the entire battle? God didn't say to hold it up the whole time. God just raised it up as a note. Hey, attack now, attack now. He didn't. He held it the whole time. Have any of you tried to hold up any object for a whole day or most of a day? Because he started this early morning. I'm assuming it's actually probably his right-handed. I don't know. Whichever hand it was. And not bring it down again. What does that mean to the people who are fighting around you? Well, all of them know that a human can't do this. It gives encouragement to note, though, unlike before when we tried to take over I and lost, this time the power of God's with us. It's a way of continuously saying God's here with us, because we are already know Moses couldn't do it either. He was a man. He was unable to do it. It took Jacob, and it took, I don't know, the other person with him.
Joshua.
I keep saying Jacob. Joshua and Caleb.
Or
somebody else. Holding Moses' hands up because Moses couldn't do it. His hands would fall down. He was exhausted. Well, in Joshua's case, he's an old man too, just as old as Moses was. Held his hand up and there was no other assistance. So he did not take it down to the end of the battle. It was a way of demonstrating God's here with us. This is a difference than before. I like Joshua. He was an amazing individual.
I also find it interesting, it says here, my translation refers to this as a javelin. It says, stretch out the javelin that is in your hand towards Ai.
Towards I, yeah.
So he didn't have it like straight up in the air.
Well, that's true. He did have it
probably,
pointed.
If it's a javelin, he probably had it pointed towards the city, saying that's where
you're
going.
Right.
And pointing that way.
Now, and that's a great point. He was pointing toward the city, and that is the direction to head. Now, granted, looking at a topographical map as far as where they're located, which I did not bring one, although we have a nice political map of modern day to look at, it points out that the approximate distance is roughly about a mile to 2 miles of the battlefield of Ai, because that's the size of the little valley that they were in, besides the southeast corner they could have escaped from. So all the ambush people would have known, they obviously know where Ai is, or Ai is. They can see the town. They don't need someone to say, point to them. Hey, by the way, that's the town. But it's a symbol.
Yeah.
It's to point out, look, go there or do this. And all the people then run in and take over the town, burn it all up. Kill anybody who survived the fire, thus 12,000 or 12 clans, however you want to argue it, people died. Any comments so far? Ellie.
It's kind of kind of funny that one person has to stand up so that other people have courage to do so also.
And which is typical of all leaders.
Yep.
When, yes, Louise, hold on a second.
Okay, Golda Meir, who wasn't, quote, religious, flew low in an airplane with the big doors open. It was over the 74 war or the 67 war, and the men were just holding her arms up, and all the troops could see Golda Meir going back and forth like this.
So it gives the courage that is needed to do it.
Yeah.
Yes, Pat, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's fine. She had a hand up. Why did they bring the king to Joshua to kill?
The king is an interesting character in this story. The king of Ai, which I can't give you a direct symbolism. I won't go there. But he's just a standard Canaanite king. Nothing really fancy about him. As in typical in many battles, one commander is brought to the other one to show surrender. But in this case, it was obviously not surrender. It was to be executed. How did Joshua treat him?
We hung him on a tree and then buried him.
What was the one thing he didn't do? Or what was the condition he met? I mean, he met with hanging him on a tree. He took him down before the sun went down.
And he buried him.
Now, he didn't burn his... didn't burn him. He just buried him. All right? He also took him down before sunset. What does that mean? What does that symbolize? Well, we say, oh, well, it's the Messiah. Well, no, not necessarily. Yes, you could argue that, but I'm not. He's treating him as he would a fellow Israelite.
Respect.
That's out of respect. Because God commanded any of you who commit a sin, what sin did I commit, the king of Ai? Well, he killed 36 men. Israelites, that, as far as they're concerned, that's a sin. He killed them, and it's worthy of a death penalty. The Israelites didn't burn Achan because of killing the men. They just stoned him. They burned Achan because God said, burn him. Well, I was not worthy of burnt. God didn't say burn the king. Burn to be, quote, symbolically cut off. He wasn't really part of it to begin with. They just killed him. Treated in the same way they would any Israelite worthy of death. You hang them, take the body down, because it is symbolic of God. And that's stated in the Torah, so it's in the law. Let's see, Deuteronomy 21, go look it up yourself. If somebody is guilty of a death penalty, they are killed, but their body must be taken down out of respect because it's symbolic of God, a human being's body, symbolic of God. You do not disgrace God in this manner. Take them down before sunset. Bury them, in this case, he buried them amongst rocks and stones in the town that he ruled. So he treated him, his opponent, as he would have treated any Israelite doing the same scenario. Equally. Even though he was Gentile. It's a matter of respect and following all the laws that God gave through Moses. And that's exactly what he did. So Ai, the king of Ai, is you could argue, is, so there's other symbolism going on there, which I'm not going to go into. I haven't looked into it enough.
No.
But at least he was treated equally. He was treated as an equal to all the Israelites, as far as his death was concerned. Okay, I'm going to stop regarding the Battle of Ai. We're going to move over to Shechem. This actually, to me, is interesting. Shechem's story is regarding Deuteronomy chapter 27, which Moses commands the people, when you come through the city out of the River Jordan, take some rocks, coat them in plaster, write on them the words of this law. Now, does that mean all 613 commandments of the entire Torah? No. Referring to the law that Moses is now giving you, which is 12 curses as well as like three or four blessings, write them on these stones and put them up on Mount Ebal. Split the tribes in two. Half are on Gerizim. Gerizim's on the south. Half are on Gerizim. Half are on Ebal, and make an altar on Ebal, which is the northern side of Shechem. These mountains are about 3 miles apart from each other, roughly. If you're standing in the middle and you're a really powerful voice, you could probably yell to one side and yell to the other side, as if you're facing them.
facing each mountain respectively. So they're not far distances. The people, it says, were not on the tops of the mountains. They were along the side of it, in along the valley of Shechem. So it's a really easy way of getting this Nablus, I think, is the town there today, which you look on a map and find it. So you have these tribes split both ways. What is this symbolizing, by the way? Anybody have any ideas? Well, you could argue two tribes, which is, I won't say that's wrong. Well, let's look at the mountains themselves. The mountains have a history. Actually, marking one of those mountains has a very extensive history, and one has none whatsoever up until this point. Mount Gerizim is a pagan mountain. It is full of lush and green and wonderful things. Today, it's still full of trees and shrubbery and lively and little living creatures and whatnot, rodents and that live on these mountains. What does Ebal have?
Nothing.
Rocks. Just rocks. Nothing lives on Mount Ebal. It's a little bit taller, actually, I think, than Gerizim. But that's it. Nothing alive. There's nothing there. No houses are built there today. Even there's no houses built there. Gerizim has lots of houses all around it because it's a very nice, pretty area. But Ebal has got nothing. They're only 3 miles away from each other, which is kind of interesting. How could a mountain 3 miles away have completely opposite environments that allow life and one allows nothing to live? Yeah, as Ken just pointed out, life and death. This is a crossroads. This is mountains divide the city of Shechem on both, actually to protect it, on both sides of it. This area of Shechem has a rich history in the book of Genesis. This area is the location where, well, is one of the locations that is what is commonly called the gateway of Israel. Why is it called the gateway? Well, if you were on the west side of Shechem, east side of Shechem, I apologize, looking west, you see Shechem in the middle, you see mountains on each side, and what do you keep seeing? Keep going looking forward, you see very little, actually. It's a valley, the Shomron Valley, which is where we get the term Samaritan from, the Samaritan Valley. It's a long valley. There are mountains on all sides, and the mountains aren't really tall. They're fairly short, relatively speaking, but it's a valley. It's a very long, quite a distance. It actually travels upwards like almost 10 or 15 miles straight. Keep going. It's called a gateway. Gerizim, when they've done archaeological studies and whatnot, and even today they still have lots of them, has temples of every pagan god you can think of all over it. Even today it still has them. Ruins, that is, of them. Not necessarily operating ones, but ruins of them. What does Ebal have still today?
That's rocks.
Except about 4 years ago they found something on Ebal. Want to guess what it was?
Give us a
painted rocks.
They didn't find the painted rocks, no. But they found an altar.
Oh my goodness.
Not just any altar. An altar to the precise dimensions and specifications of a Jewish or Israelite altar. Precise to the orientation, the way it was shaped, where everything was located on Mount Ebal. Now they said, well, could this be Joshua's altar? Probably not. Couldn't be. And then they dug. Now, this altar was refined. It was well structured. This was a hewn stone. Joshua's was unhewn stone. But it was still to perfect specifications. Matter of fact, it was the same specifications given for, or almost the same, not quite, because rocks do fall and move a little bit over years, but very close, within a few cubits, of the specifications for the tent of the tabernacle of meeting. Same size, same dimensions, same specs. When we always argue that the temple went to Shiloh or went to Jerusalem, blah, 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 blah. Yes, it did. But one could equally argue for a while at least, and they noted it's about that this altar was in operation for at least a few years. It was probably on Mount Ebal as well for a few years. There's a reason why Mount Ebal has nothing else that grows on it. Nothing else lives there. Nothing else is allowed to live there. It's a holy mountain for a brief period of time of its history. What did they find underneath this wonderful, hewn, perfect Israelite altars?
Rocks.
And by the way, this wasn't just an altar. This was an altar. These were walls, specks. These were separation barriers they found of the foundation, that is. So it actually had, and they actually proved beyond reasonable doubt that it actually is Israelite. And they found out how they do this. This, how could you prove something that's over 3,000 years old? You can't prove it. Well, actually, you can. As you dig, what do you find typically under altars? Ashes. Bones. Any ash? Any particular bones? Only of clean animals if it's Israelite.
Yeah.
Only of animals that are pre-cut to a specific dimensions to fit on an altar. Now, not cut like we think of, oh, you go to the butcher and cut up a bone. No, that's for eating.
Mm-hmm.
For non-eating, completely burned, you break it up differently. They found 940 different animals in the ashes beneath this altar amongst the ground. All of them burned to a crisp, as far as the bones. They found of all these bones, only two were of unclean animals, and they were a rabbit, which probably died there, and some other rodent that had most likely died. And then they weren't burned. They probably just happened to be in an area and died years later. All the other 938 animals were of cattle, a year old or younger, less than a year old, sheep, less than a year old, goats, less than a year old, and a few local clean deer, which were probably offerings to God in general. 938 different animals, species, or different animals found, not species, they're all just those four species, but all 938 were found there. Joshua's altar, the one he built, was also found there, directly beneath the altar that was matched to the Jewish specifications. Because they kept digging. Well, what's underneath it? They found another altar, slightly smaller dimensions, of unhewn stone. What did they find there in this altar? They found Egyptian coins. Two Egyptian coins. Both coins dated to Thutmose III and IV. When they left Egypt, what pharaoh was in charge? Thutmose IV was the one who was, I think his son was in charge. His son was the one who killed, or died. The fifth is the one who died, the young boy. So they actually have physical stuff that noted this is where the altar was. Nothing else lives there. Now this is just interesting information, right? Doesn't mean a whole lot. Because who cares? It's no big deal. Well, it's big deal because in Messiah's time, the Samaritan woman showed up. And she was saying, our fathers used to worship on this mountain. The Jews say, no, you go to Jerusalem. Now, she was not talking about Mount Ebal. Don't get that confused. What mountain was she talking about?
Gerizim.
The other mountain. Well, what's found on Mount Gerizim? Lots and lots of pagan idols and as well as many altars. What did the Jews of the time, now this we're talking about, it's not in biblical history, but it's in chronological history, Josephus recorded as well, about 100 years or so before Messiah was born, about 150 years, depending on who you argue, which book you read. What were the Jews telling the Samaritans? You want to be Jewish, you're allowed to worship in Jerusalem, or where else? Mount Ebal, 3 miles away. You choose. One or the other, you do not worship on Gerizim. And the Samaritans say, well, why not? We have built our temples on Gerizim. We have always been worshiping Gerizim for hundreds of years. Why should we obey the Jews who say go to Jerusalem? Or have also given the alternative to go to Ebal, which is only 3 miles away. It's quite easy to do. What did the Messiah say? You will come a time, you will not worship this mountain or Jerusalem or for that matter at all. The location wasn't really important, per se, once Messiah dies. But up to that point, these two mountains have a huge history. All the curses and all the people of Israel, sorry, northern side, right-hand side, or left, anyway, of the northern side where Mount Ebal is, they said this mountain, it contained the temple for a period of time, not the temple that Solomon built, but the tabernacle at least, for a period of time. It's still holy. It's okay to worship your God on holy ground. It's not okay to worship your God, no matter how pretty it looks, on unholy ground. Blessings and cursings. You divide it up. This is the gateway to the land of Israel. This is the choice. This is the place where you say, I will follow this, or I will follow that. Why? Because one looks pretty.
It looks pretty.
It looks, all these blessings, it looks pretty. And what is the other one? There's death over there. I ain't going over there. There's nothing worthwhile. That's worthless. It's harder. And what did the Israelites do when Joshua read off all these curses and blessings? Amen. We'll do it. Because, see, unlike when they left Egypt with Moses, they all kind of had to work for 40 solid years trying to convince themselves, okay, I'll work on, I'll do this. Another rule? Come on, Moses. Write it down in a book. Do something else to them. Don't give them to me. Well, that generation dies. The next generation says, okay, yeah, Moses, we'll follow these rules. We'll wander around anyway. We've got nothing else to do. Well, now we're in our new territory. Do we still want to follow them? Well, you have rules. Are you going to follow them? Yes or no? Well, Shechem's a little gateway because it's a choice. It's a moment which you choose. Will you follow what is looks nice and is easy in the territory which you are going to? Or you follow what is difficult and hard? Yes or no? They all said amen, and they all will follow what is hard. Now, as my mother mentioned earlier, the separation of two houses, they're not broken up in a symbolic fashion, like in the fact that Joseph, including Ephraim and Manasseh, are all mixed together with Judah on one mountain, which happens to be the Mount Gerizim, the pretty one. And Issachar and a few others are grouped together on the other mountain. So they're not broken up into a two-house scenario. But they are broken up into a choice scenario. Where did God bring Abraham? Shechem. First.
He chose.
Where did God bring, where did Abraham and Lot show up at? Actually, they showed up at Ai. But also, and Abraham said, hey, Lot, which way do you want to go? How Lot went south? Abraham stayed where he was and eventually moved on to Hebron, or where Hebron's at. But these scenarios, these two little places, and by the way, Ai and Bethel or in Shechem, they're not that far from each other. There's two mountains that separate them. Ebal is one of them, or Gerizim is one of the mountains, and I forgot what the name of the other one was. But that's it. They're very close to each other. But Abraham traveled to Shechem first, and God said, this is the territory. What do you like? What do you think? This is a gateway. This is your doorway. You want it? Yes or no? Okay. I'll take it. They actually have a rich history. Now, Abraham did not build an altar in Shechem. One had argued that, well, maybe the Ebal was his mountain he chose. No, he didn't. He chose it further south. But yes, Ellie.
He brought Joseph to Shechem too.
Yes, he brought Joseph to Shechem. And guess who else was buried in Shechem? Lots and lots and lots of people buried in Shechem. Shechem's an important important place. All the people of Shechem.
He brought Joseph to Shechem.
And buried him there.
And had to decide where to go. He came to Shechem for directions. And he took the directions from Shechem.
Oh, yes. Yes. Joseph did.
Jacob
did that.
Jacob.
No.
Joseph?
Joseph.
I'm not sure about that. Oh, yes, he did.
He didn't go there. He's heading.
He stopped.
And he was stopped.
He stopped in the valley of Shechem.
Stopped in the valley. We didn't go to the city.
Well, that's all right. Close enough.
I know.
This is a valley. You're right. I missed that. You're absolutely right. Joseph did go to Shechem, and an angel said,
over there.
They're not here. Don't enter the city. Go over there. Wait, that's a whole other story as to what that means, which is very important. It has to do with the name of Shechem, what the name means, what it symbolizes when the sons came over and slaughtered the city, and why Joseph was not allowed to enter in yet again. Now, he was going to be buried there, but he was not allowed to enter it yet because he wasn't supposed to die yet. Shechem was where Joseph was going to be buried, not where anything else was going to be buried. So anyway, but I won't go into it right now. Who else? There was one. Oh, yes, right. Jacob was in Shechem. And Jacob bought territory in Shechem. So Shechem is actually legally Israelite territory. So those are your tidbits. Jacob bought it. He didn't just buy it. He bought a particular mountain. I'll give you one guess which mountain he bought was.
Ebal.
He bought the mountain of Ebal. It's a worthless mountain.
Who wants that?
Nothing grows there. He bought it. It was his. Nothing else was built there ever since. It has lots of rich history. These two mountains have a history in not only Samaritan religion today, as well as Jewish religion and history as well. I got to stop some more time. Yes, Ellie, have one last question?
I'm just wondering. I know that after the fall of the temple, that one of the daughters of one of the priests, or the high priest, married a Samaritan, and the Samaritans built a replica of the tabernacle, and even they still use that today.
Location today, yes.
That
actually is directly on top of Mount Gerizim. That particular tabernacle is. So in history, during Alexander the Great, he had conquered Israel, took over the area, and the Samaritans got together and said, "Hey, Alexander, these Jews don't believe in you. Let's go destroy their temple." And Alexander said, "Okay, go right ahead." He didn't care. Well, within a year's time. We're not quite sure how that actually happened. But one Israelite commander who was the high priest also showed up to Alexander and said, "Stop, wait a minute." He was dressed in his garb. Now, Alexander had already had a vision of this particular dressed individual in his dreams. And he said, "This person, whoever they are, I'm supposed to follow what they say." Well, this guy who happened to be dressed up in the high priest's robes, happened to be, he did it on purpose, dressed up and said, "Hey, I got to talk to you." And what did Alexander say? "This is the guy. This is my dream. What do you want?" He said, "Don't destroy the Jewish temple. Take out the one in Gerizim instead." And Alexander said, "You got it." So they wiped out the Samaritan temple on Gerizim, which the Romans rebuilt and renamed Temple Zeus, after Zeus, directly on top. It has lots of pagan history. By the way, don't feel bad for Samaritans. These people are not honorable people, typically. There's a reason why Jews didn't like them back in Messiah's time. Yes, did they believe in the supreme God? Of course. Did they believe in lots of other gods? Of course. They didn't just worship the God of Israel. They worshiped lots and lots and lots of gods. That was part of the Samaritan religion, and still part of it spills over today. They believe there's one supreme God and a bunch of little tiny gods that rule your individual lives. So you can have one supreme and then pray to a few smaller ones to keep them all happy. Samaritan religion is not a pleasant one. It does interact with Jewish religion in that it was advocated that this one supreme God is the ultimate one. That was done by King Ahasuerus, which we read in Purim. He commanded, "Hey, Jews, go teach these Samaritans about your religion, because they're living in territory and lions are killing Samaritans. They're coming over and just taking over, but they leave you Jews alone. So go tell them to pray against the lions." And since the Jews did a whole couple of years of instructing Samaritans about God of Israel, about what granted there was some intermingling with marriage as well, about what their history was, and moved on into what it was developed. Today there's less than like 1,000 Samaritans left alive. Most of them were slaughtered by various people. But that's a minor history rundown of Samaritan religion. Any other questions? I'm going to call it quits. Thank you. It was a pleasant discussion.